7, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. It's always good to see you. And now we have a new smiling face joining us today, which we'll get to with Mike here in a little bit. But it is an interesting week for, of course, aviation safety and accidents. A couple of recent current events that we're tracking right now. One involves an older 737-400, 27-year-old airplane that used to be operated by Aeroflot in Russia, was converted into a cargo airplane and went into service with K2 Aviation, an Indonesian carrier that was headed to Pakistan. So one of the things that we'll be chatting about with Mike and, of course, John, since Todd and I are going to be sitting in the background here asking questions, and that is we're going to talk about some of the maintenance issues that could possibly play into the cause of this accident, given the fact that one or both pilots had reported some sort of flight instrument issues. It's not really determined yet or known what the extent of that issue was, but we know from at least radar data, ADS-B data, that the aircraft did get into a vertical dive, was pulled out, did a zoom climb of about 6,000 feet above its cruise altitude of 35,000 feet, and then went into a high vertical descent, high energy descent, crashed into the water. So we'll be talking a little more about that. And then, of course, we're going to be chatting about another current event, and that is a flight instructor with a female student. And there is some discussion about whether or not she was already a licensed pilot, just hadn't flown in a while and was getting recurrent. But the flight instructor, 42 years old, the student in this case was a young lady in her early 20s, and they were doing some sort of maneuvers, and the flight instructor decided to leave the aircraft voluntarily without a parachute. And Todd and I chatted offline about this because we've seen another event in the recent past involving a professional pilot, a young man who was a co-pilot on a CASA 212, who, again, because of some mental issues and that kind of thing, and unfortunately made a hard landing and broke an airplane, took it upon himself then to leave that aircraft while in flight. So we're going to be chatting about that. And then, of course, with Mike, and we're happy to have you. As always, we always look for, you know, some expertise because the three of us are worthless. So we're glad that somebody's bringing some expertise to this group. We're going to be talking about these maintenance issues with the 737. And then, of course, we want to talk about you being an engineer. And I can make a lot of jokes about that, but we'll save that for later. So Gentlemen, let's start off with this K2 airplane. It is an older 737, and apparently took off, got to cruise, was in cruise, and everything was ops normal until shortly before this high-speed event. I know, Todd, you've been scouring the internet looking for information. Why don't you bring us up to date with what you got?
Well, this is a fairly new event, and what we have been able to determine, and you can see from the graphic that's gone on the screen right now, there has been some wreckage recovered from this aircraft by the Pakistani Navy. And from this other graphic, you can see that it took off from near Dubai, going to the east toward Pakistan, and it was about 3/4 of the way to Karachi when it went into, for whatever reason, like you said before, it was making some altitude changes, made a turn more than 90 degrees as though it were turning away from Pakistan, going to the south toward the deeper part of the ocean, and it went into a very high speed dive and crashed. And one thing I can say is that I don't know the depth of the water there, but given that the aircraft is in pieces, only floating debris was found, it may be unlikely that there will be a effort by the Pakistani authorities or any authority to get the cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder. So understanding what went on could be kind of problematic. But the other thing that's clear about this was a 737-400, older aircraft, had spent some considerable amount of time with Aeroflot, flying in passenger service before being converted to cargo use. And this was also the only aircraft in the inventory of this company, from what we've been able to determine, which brings up a whole host of issues about what sort of oversight, what sort of history this aircraft may have had, what kind of mission it was flying, whether or not there might have been, I don't know, given that part of the world with the things going on, perhaps this was not an accident but a deliberate action. All under the responsibility of the investigating authority.
It's a Boeing airplane, so it is a product of the United States. We are required, even though, you know, it is 27 years old, we still have airworthiness responsibilities. You know, that's one of the FAA's missions. So whether or not we actually send people either from the NTSB and or the FAA is to be yet to be determined. But those airplanes are still operating around the world, even though they are old. And of course, a lot of them are parked in the desert right now. But we do have a responsibility. And if it is suspected to be some sort of mechanical malfunction or failure, of course, they're going to need the assistance of Boeing and or FAA and NTSB. John, you and Mike, you know, turned wrenches on a lot of these older airplanes and, of course, these converted airplanes. And again, the information is very cryptic from what the pilots reported, that they had some sort of flight instrument issue shortly before the airplane took a nosedive and then zoom climbed up 6,000 feet and then went into its final descent. You know, when you talk about operating on a shoestring, as Todd said, this is really about the only airplane they have in their fleet. And given that part of the world, given the economic state of possibly this particular airline, what kind of issues from an investigative standpoint would you be digging into, you know, right now? Even though we don't have any real wreckage to examine and we don't have, of course, any cockpit voice recorder, flight data recorder, what issues would you be looking at right now with the carrier, with the maintenance records, and of course, the repair and maintenance history?
Well, immediately you want those records because this airplane came out of Russia in 24, and that really got my attention immediately because in early 24, I was actually approached by some entities that were bringing airplanes out of Russia, and they wanted to get them back on Western certification. And I declined to be involved with that. But that was interesting that that was early in 24, and this airplane came out of Russia in 24. That means it was operating under sanctions for more than 10 years. So parts sanctions and God knows what else transpired while it was in Russia. So the history of the airplane and the maintenance records will come to the forefront immediately while others are looking to bring up the wreckage. And the second thing that comes to mind immediately is the fact that that rudder PCU had been a problem in the past. We've had two crashes here in the U.S., and we had a number of occurrences, incidents that involved the rudder PCU, which would make the airplane behave crazy like this one did. So they certainly want to get that rudder PCU up. But from a maintenance point of view, there's things that should have been done to that airplane over the last 15 years that to keep track of that rudder PCU and make sure the maintenance program was followed. And did Russia have a maintenance program? And Mike, you could add a little bit to that for the rudder PCU, since your background was flight certification.
Yeah, actually, I was on the flight test program. I did some autopilot flight testing for the Classics, which is the 737-300 and 400. And it was before the PCU event started to happen. But, you know, just looking at the way this thing happened, I would certainly want to take a look at the controls and the autopilot as well. Not to mention, you know, when this modification was done and how the maintenance was managed after that, how many hours and cycles and so on were put on this airplane after it was modified to carry cargo. So that's those are two issues. And of course, you know, you guys know this more than anybody else. The fact is, we're going to wait till we have all the information. But two things really stick out for me, and that is that the operational history, when the modification was done, and anything related to the autopilot and the controls in general.
So I should have said when I first raised the PCU that, you know, we love to use acronyms here, but we have audience that may not understand it. So PCU stands for Power Control Unit. It is actually a hydraulic unit that drives the tail of the airplane. The pilot drives the PCU, which is really easy to drive. It's like power steering. But the unit itself, the power control unit, is what moves the rudder left or right. And when they go bad, they can move the rudder without any inputs from the cockpit. And then we had two accidents because of that we know of, and a number of incidents that didn't result in an accident. So
I would imagine they're very maintenance sensitive as well, those PCUs.
Maintenance sector, it's a sensitive unit. In fact, I think the only person that really understands that PCU is the guy who designed it. I mean, it is a complicated piece of machine. I spent probably over 100 hours just learning the basics of how that PCU operated through its whole range. It's a tiny little unit that does a heck of a lot.
And this was a unit that was involved in the, what was it, the 94 U.S. air crash in Pennsylvania?
Correct. And Colorado Springs.
Colorado Springs, yep.
Yeah. And United Airlines 585.
Yep. East Wind Airlines had an event. United Airlines had two events, and aside from the Colorado, where it malfunctioned, but it didn't result in a crash because the pilots were on top of it. So, you know, it's always going to be suspect.
And let me emphasize that this particular event that happened with the airline, it was a Pakistani registration. It was going to Pakistan, so I believe by Annex 13, they will be the investigating authority. And whether or not they are going to investigate that aspect of it, we don't know. The only report I was able to see on the media was that allegedly one of the crew members radioed that they had some sort of navigational problem. Whether that meant they lost the horizon or they lost control of the aircraft, that was not specified. So as with any accident, everything is ruled in, nothing's ruled out at the beginning.
Yeah, and when you look at this, you know, a lot of these airlines that when I was doing work for the board going overseas, they deferred a lot of stuff on their airplanes. And so, you know, whether or not that plays into it with what John and Mike were talking about, and that is, you know, looking at the maintenance records, looking at what's been deferred, how long it's been deferred. And if it's a critical, you know, flight related system, navigation, instrumentation, whatever the case may be, was everything operational, you know, not only on the day of the flight, but had it been flying with deferred items that should have been fixed and may have caused or contributed to the accident. So these are all the things that can at least start the process for the investigators to be examining right now, so that when they do, if they do pull not only substantial wreckage, but if they do recover a cockpit voice recorder and a flight data recorder, and there's no guarantee that either of those two boxes had been maintained and were working properly. So they may not have all of the good stuff that we would expect from a cockpit voice recorder or flight data recorder. And that's why examining the physical wreckage is so critical in accidents like these, because you may not always have the data that you need to really give a complete storyline as to what may have caused or contributed to the accident.
And
So.
let us move quickly to the other current event that we wanted to talk about a little bit. This was in Argentina and involved a flight instructor and a student and a Cessna 150, which, for those of you who are not familiar with the 150, imagine a 172, but only smaller, seating only two instead of four, and it's not a lot of space in there to move around. But somehow, for whatever reason, the flight instructor, very calmly, according to the student, very calmly arranged some of his personal items and opened the door and left the aircraft. Unfortunately, this flight instructor is no longer with us. The student was able to land the aircraft. And it brings up not an issue of what happened, because that seems to be fairly clear, but why it happened, and more specifically, the role of mental health in aviation. And this is not the first time this kind of pilot taking a leave of the aircraft in flight has happened, but it brings up a larger picture. How do you find out if somebody has a mental health issue and intervene so that this sort of thing doesn't happen? Is this sort of thing even being talked about openly in whatever community these pilots are in, among other things?
Well, I see it because my office partner is a forensic psychologist, aviation forensic psychologist. So he is dealing with mental health issues, not only for pilots, but mechanics as well, and others that are involved in aviation. And, you know, it cuts across the board. But John, we talked about this previously on other shows, but it brings that question back up. You know, we've had intentional acts where German wings, we have a pilot who takes the airplane down. We have Egypt Air, where we have a pilot who takes the airplane down. But we also now have pilots that, again, you know, if nothing else, and to coin that term, suicide by airplane, using the airplane as a means for them to take their own life. In this case, you know, the FAA, we've been raising this issue now for several years, and it's come really into the spotlight in the last 2 or 3 years, where mental health issues in aviation are to be addressed. And I know that, you know, Congress has seen a bill regarding mental health, and it apparently is still sitting there, as far as you know, that you've told us about.
Well, the bill in Congress has been introduced in multiple Congresses, at least 7 years running. The bill has been there. And earlier, a year ago, I was on a show with Nathan Fielder, which was a sort of a comedy, but a comedy around a very serious subject of mental health. And the problem is that pilots that need to get help, that may recognize they need to get help, are afraid to go get the help because it will impact on their certificate. The FAA has taken a very hard line that says if you do anything with mental health issues, you're going to be grounded. And that today we're smarter than we were years ago, and we know that you can deal with some of those issues without grounding and without taking a person out of service, so to speak. So there's been a push for a while now to change that law. And after the Nathan Fielder and HBO and their program, there was a big push. It was always stuck in the House of Representatives. The House committee that held it up all those years voted it out. Very quickly, the House of Representatives voted it forward, where it's not just a get out of jail free law, it allows for the treatment. It allows you to get the help. It's gone to the US Senate. It has come out of the Senate committee vote. It's now sitting on the Senate floor waiting for a vote. If it passes this vote, if it ever gets brought up, it passes the vote, it'll go to the White House for signature. We need to have that bill passed. We need to start to identify what we need, what kind of treatments and what kind of mitigation we need to address this issue.
From the latest I've seen from congress.gov, it's referred to the Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation, and obviously has not passed the Senate. It was referred to that committee back in September of 2025, so it's been quite a few months. And this is also an issue because if it's not passed by this Congress, which ends at the beginning of 2027, if it doesn't pass by then, it will have to be reintroduced all over again in the next Congress, which will be taking shape in January of 2027.
Yeah, and mental health has always been a stigma, especially, you know, in aviation, for the reasons that John talked about, and that is it has an adverse effect on your certificate. And of course, if you're a career professional pilot, puts you on the ground. And a lot of times it's very difficult to get that certificate or that clearance to go back into the cockpit. But the fact is that it shouldn't be one of those, you know, behind the curtain, talk in the shadows about this issue, because there's probably a lot of people that have a lot of issues that are fearful of bringing it, you know, forward. And then all of a sudden we have these issues in flight. We had a JetBlue captain who got on a flight. Everything was ops normal. They took off. And next thing you know, he left the cockpit and went on a public rant in the passenger cabin. And of course, the flight attendants, first officer, were concerned about that. They locked the cockpit door, put the airplane on the ground, and that pilot, I think, went to jail. So when you look at these things, yes, is it hard to trap line who has mental, you know, illness or some sort of life-altering event that would trigger some, you know, abnormal behavior, unusual behavior? Is that behavior temporary because of that life-changing event, or is this something more systemic that is progressing? I mean, those are the difficult questions to really answer. Trained professionals can make a better determination, but the people have to be in there, and you have to have at least a trap line. I mean, again, for us to be pilots, we have to hold a current medical certificate, especially as professional pilots. You have to hold a current medical certificate. And depending on the type of flying you're doing, it's either every 6 months, 12 months, or 24 months. But the bigger question is, how do we trap line that? Well, the professionals have a better way of doing that. But unless we have a pathway to return to the cockpit, it's going to be very difficult for people to voluntarily say, you know what, I've got issues, or have at least a medical professional bring those forward, knowing that in some cases it could end an aviator's career. So it has to be addressed. We've been talking about it. The FAA has been talking about it. I just sat on a panel not too long ago with Susan Norton, who is the FAA medical aeromedical person who is leading this charge. And, you know, again, we shouldn't be talking about it in the shadows, but it is one of those difficult situations. Why we may never know exactly what caused that flight instructor to voluntarily take his life. They may get some information from family members about, you know, again, a life-altering event. There was an in-depth discussion and examination of the young man who left the aircraft involved in an accident, a CASA 212, back three, four years ago. There were some life-altering changes in his life, and so you can attribute a lot of these things to those kinds of issues. But to just write it off and say, well, it was a one-off, it wasn't really, it's not a systemic problem, that simply isn't true in this day and age, especially given the fact that a lot of the accidents that I've been looking at recently, There are a lot of pilots on various drugs, both prescribed and not prescribed, that I've seen in the tox screens that come back when there's a fatal accident. And with all the medication that's circulating out there, and of course, the liberation, if you will, of the use of THC and gummies and brownies and edible and whatever you want to call it. Again, people are doing these things for whatever reason, but they're showing up in their system while they are operating an aircraft. And again, we don't know the influence of all of these types of drugs that influence bad decision making or whatever. But the fact is that this kind of issue does need to be addressed.
Over-the-counter drugs, which everybody thinks are pretty easy, there many of those are on the do not
No
fly
fly
list.
list. Yep.
So I
Yeah.
mean, there's drugs out there that we just go to the drugs, they'll CVS or whatever the drugstore, and pick them up because they don't need a prescription. But take some of certain ones of those drugs, you can't fly. So pilots need to pay attention to that as well.
And for those of you who want to
So,
follow up on mental health and aviation, we've actually done two different shows on that recently. The one you just mentioned, Greg, about the CASA 212, that was our episode 239 that we did in 2024. And more recently, we had an extended conversation with a GA pilot who'd gone through her own issues with mental health and recertification. That was episode 307. And we have graphics of those for those of you watching the video version of this. So I invite you both to anyone who's interested to watch those two shows.
well, with
That
that, I'm flying away. I
I
have another commitment. So, gentlemen, it's good to see you
Very
and look
good.
forward to our next episode.
Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety. From incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks, first access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in, because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before. All right,
And
so
with
we have a
that,
lot of discussion today around another issue, and that's the shortage of pilots, shortage of mechanics. I recently did an interview with I even forget who it was. I do so many of them. But the most recent one, where I mentioned that the average age of a mechanics in the for the major airlines is hovering around 60 years old. In United Airlines, it has 14,000 mechanics. Their average age is just under 60 years old, which means that in 5 to 7 years, they're going to need 7,000 mechanics. The other piece that's not getting a lot of play is how many engineers we have that are missing. We went through a number of years here in the US where our engineering students, graduating students, has been very, very low. In fact, I read a couple of years ago where Mexico graduated more engineers that year than we did in the United States. And their population's a lot smaller than ours. So that's a really telling comment.
now, one
So
engineer who is not missing is our own Mike Borfitz. Thank you again for being with us. And before we get into that, you were telling us off the air your engineering journey. Unlike many, like myself, who started right after high school and got their degree, you went through a different route, which, by the way, for those of you who are out there who are active duty, listen to this route because it could be paid for by the U.S. government.
Yes, indeed. Hi, everybody. Yeah, so my academic history is kind of colorful, but I can just let very quickly let it be known that I somewhere in the bowels of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, there's a 0.5 GPA with my name on it. So obviously, I wasn't ready. And by the way, that school has a well-earned reputation for being a party school. So I decided it was probably best just to get to work. I wound up doing 4 years in the Air Force. To avoid the draft, I was an aircraft loadmaster, C-141s. I was a dock builder for a while. I was a tree climber, landscaper. I drove trucks for a little bit. I was a motorcycle mechanic, and so on and so forth. Then it came to my attention that the Veterans Administration could put me through school. And luckily, the individual I was speaking with ran a bit of a test on me, and he said you could be an engineer. Not really knowing what engineering is all about, I also found out that probably pretty good job security being an engineer. So I wound up going to a community college because I was way behind on math. I got myself into a 4-year college, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, RPI, upstate New York, and got my degree. I did it in 4 years, but I was really, really determined to get there. And I was at a point where I was old enough that I was able to focus on what I had to do. And I graduated in 1980 at the ripe old age of 31. And I since then I've been working as an aeronautical engineer. That was my degree at the time. So it was an interesting route, but I got there and it's the best thing I ever could have done professionally and personally. It was a great way to go.
And these days, as in 2026, there's a lot of interest in tech, not necessarily traditional engineering, but the tech that could make one megabucks, which is already fine and good. And that might be drawing away some of the talent that would have gone into engineering in earlier years. But that's not to say that you can't go back to it later. So if you have the skills and the determination, you don't have to do it right now. If you have something else interesting, that's great. But if you want to have engineering as part of your career, you're not losing out if you don't start at age 18.
Exactly. Yeah. And, there's STEM educations out there. That's science, technology, engineering, and math. I suggest anybody wants to get an engineering, even thinking about it, you can't go wrong with that kind of a primary education. Absolutely not. It's probably a good way to go.
Yeah. And, the field is wide open. If you can work in anywhere, there's all kinds of engineering. You get a mechanical engineering degree. You can work in aviation, you can work on railroads, you can work in maritime. I mean, you can work anywhere across the board.
Yeah, mechanical engineering. If you get your degree in mechanical, you're a Swiss knife. You can work just about anywhere. Absolutely no doubt about it. Some of the other engineering disciplines can be very, very narrowly focused. But the bottom line, I'm an aero, and you think that just has to do with de designing wings. But I wound up getting into all kinds of other things. Once you get that piece of paper, you can go any number of directions. No doubt
And
about it. I
my
want to add, by the way.
background was electrical, and I became someone involved in aviation. And there's plenty of opportunity in every aspect of technology, especially engineering, to have a path in aviation. And I mentioned earlier about those who are active duty in the military in the U.S. right now. The current GI Bill is much more generous than it was when I was in the military. Having your education paid for, especially in something like a technical school, like a technical route like engineering, much easier than it was in the past. So if you're interested and you're worried about paying for it, there's always a will. If there's a will, there will be a way, especially through the GI Bill.
I was going to say this morning I was cruising on YouTube and I came across an old piece with Elon Musk and his engineers with his engines on his rockets. And it's funny to see him so young. I don't know how old it was, but it was obvious he was a young man. And they talked about the engine that he built for the Falcon 9. He didn't build it, his engineers did. And then all these young guys that turned around and built the engine, the Merlin engine for the big rocket that he's doing. And it was really fascinating to listen to him and others go through that sequence of events getting up to that, where they were breaking new ground, building rockets with fewer pieces to them, to the engines. I mean, they just, turbo pumps were always a big problem. He redesigned the turbine pump from the ground up. And, you know, he didn't redesign it, but his young engineers did. And it's just amazing what the work. I tell you, I keep telling my, when I'm out there addressing students, I'm getting ready, I'm putting something together now to do it, to refresh my program, to do it again coming up. I wish I was younger. The potential for exciting things to work on is just unbelievable today. You know, it's,
yeah, it never ends. It just keeps growing and growing.
Right, but today it seems like it's the outgoing end of the funnel. It's just spreading out so far and so wide. I mean, it's just exciting.
Yeah, that's what I love about engineering. I'm always, always learning. It's always exciting and challenging, and it's really something. Guys, I wrote some bullet points. If you don't mind, if I go through these right quick, I wrote about the best engineers, basically what it's like to be an engineer, the types of engineers, and I have an anecdote. So I'm just going to run through this point by point, and Todd, you can join me with your own experience. The best engineers. First of all, an engineering degree basically teaches us how to think. We walk out of school with all these formulas in our head, and they basically go away pretty quickly. But what really matters is that we learn how to approach a problem and how to work with a team, among other things. A good engineer knows where he or she belongs. Like, I know that what I'm doing right now is exactly where I want to be and where I belong. It's a natural fit. Have an intuitive sense of their field. As an aero engineer, I can sort of visualize airflow. A mechanical and structural engineer can sort of visualize where the stresses and strains and loads really are. Real world experience can be helpful, and that's just from my own knot hole, you know, working in these various jobs before I got my engineering degree. It really helped me understand what the real world is about. We've had a lot of engineers who sort of live in an ivory tower, you might say, who really don't have a good practical feel for what it's all about, which then goes back to a good engineer is not afraid to get his or her hands dirty, get in there and, you know, just touch things and work with folks who actually understand what they're dealing with on the floors, because sometimes the best engineers are problem solvers who understand the most elegant solution may not necessarily be the most effective. For example, designing for maintenance reality is something that a lot of folks don't really consider. And we get a lot of grief from folks who turn wrenches and swing hammers out there. There are a couple types of engineers. One is number crunchers versus hands-on engineers. Both are needed. The number crunchers are the folks who just have, well, like what you talked about, John, the folks who actually design the pumps and the nozzles for rockets. I couldn't do that. I'm more of an intuitive kind of guy, but I make my contributions to the engineering world. And by the way, there are natural engineers who don't have a piece of paper on the wall. I've known people who can really, really come out with some amazing solutions to stuff, but they just don't have that piece of paper. The degree opens doors for you, but then it's on you. And I've also known some degreed engineers who just simply cannot engineer their way out of a wet paper bag. They just can't do it. So we have to be open to what people are really capable of or not. And a quick anecdote. When I was in the FAA, I'm retired collecting pensions from Boeing and the FAA, as well as CEO of an ODA right now, Kilroy Aviation. But there were three of us when I was in the FAA talking to high school STEM students. And they asked us, how did you get here? And each of us told our story, each of the three of us. And it turns out that none of us wound up at that moment being where we had planned to be. So there's this joke, when we make plans, God laughs. So get your degree, always lean into what feels right. Keep learning. Don't be afraid to move when you're ready. And don't be a resume builder. I've known some folks who have gotten in the FAA who have been there for like 3 years and then punched out after having put their feet up just so they could have it in their resume. Those folks are found out very, very quickly. A good engineer has a strong background and is working in whatever field that individual has chosen and fits in that field. So that's really about it. So, well, Todd,
I can
what do
speak
you
to
think?
Some of those. I think that covered a lot of ground, and many of those bullet points were familiar to me. And one of the first ones was one I thought of pretty much as soon as I graduated, that the formulas you remember Well, you don't remember them because, look, you're in school, you're there to pass tests to make the grade, but making the grade academically is not making the grade out in the field. And yes, you might have to revisit those formulas at some point in the future, and it's a difficult process to relearn them as needed. But the as needed means there's a motivation for it. And that skill that you built in school, that is, that discipline, that way of looking at things, will serve you in the long term. Now, for those of you who are about to go to school right now or in school right now, it's a world of difference. We all went to college or grew up in a world without computers, where slide rules were the things I thought I'd be using in engineering school. But we'd just gotten to the point where we had like handheld calculators, and we had one entire computer, mainframe computer, for the entire campus. I had to trudge through the snow sometimes and type things up with punch cards, carry a box of cards this thick for programs. Now you can go do your AI and talk through a situation and say, hey, put this into this kind of software. And you can do a pretty darn good job for you. Now, the skills you need as an engineer, you're not going to hand off something to something else and walk away. AI is a tool. If you have a tool in your hand, the hand still has to be involved. And that hand is your mind and your way of thinking through things. And certainly on the practical versus theoretical side, I had a lot of classroom training, not a whole lot of practical training as an undergraduate. Once I left, I actually wanted to go out and do things that were more on the operational side because, theory is great, but I wanted to be where the action was and learn from that and learn from the people who came up through different routes. And as John could probably tell you, ask a mechanic who works on an aircraft and ask an engineer who works on an aircraft how to solve a particular problem. They may come from completely different directions, but they'll add to each other's insights, and together they can do a whole lot more than either one of them could alone.
And
And that working with other people, not a social skill that was in my engineering curriculum, but being able to communicate and work with people across the board is absolutely essential. I mean, we're both at Boeing. I had this experience very early on. It's like I'm walking through this factory. There's th literally thousands of people building this aircraft. I work with an organization that had thousands of engineers, most of whom I would never meet during my Boeing career because there's just too many of them. And yet we somehow had to communicate with one another, get messages across, understand where everybody was coming from, and get a product out the door that might be flying for 50 years. And I'm just shocked to this day that somehow or another, human beings with all their frailties were able to work in a system where that could happen. Now, as an engineer, you're just part of that system. You're not the whole system, but you're an essential part of it. And if you have any good sense, you realize that there are many essential parts of which engineering is one. So if your talents and your sensibilities are in that direction, go for it.
all the technical jobs, whether engineering or on the maintenance side, they all have those opportunities. Recently, I had sat down with a senior vice president from an airline, and he had pulled up my resume, my CV. I don't even know where he got it from, but he started to question me about how, as a mechanic, how did I end up where I am today? Right, I had already been at the NTSB and already left, so he questioned me about every step of the way. And one of the things I remember from the conversation, he said, most people climb the ladder literally, straight up the ladder, rung by rung. He said, you went up crossing because I let my feelings drive where I was going. I'm a mechanic and I got exposed to human factors. And I jumped into human factors with both feet. That's not a mechanic, really. That's something else. But I bridged the gap between a mechanic and the academic side of human factors. And I can continue that all the way up. I left the board and I'm doing safety stuff. I'm doing stuff outside the box for most mechanics because I just follow the things that I like to do that I can contribute to. And it's exactly what Mike was saying, exactly what you were saying, Todd. You know, just follow what you feel. Don't get stuck in a pigeonhole. Just follow what you feel.
I've heard the word is passion. Follow your passion. It
Right.
matters. It really does. It makes things so much better. I'm 77 years old. I love what I do. My partners are going to carry me out on a board for crying out loud.
And
Yes, that's the way
also,
I feel as well.
you don't know what the future may bring. I mean, many of you who are watching the news now might have heard that SpaceX became public and they're minting perhaps hundreds of people who are going to get going from barely putting two nickels together being worth tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm sure that virtually everyone in that organization, other than maybe Elon Musk and the high-level executives, ever dreamed that this could be possible for them. But those who were below that, those who didn't know about, stock options and all that, who are working hard at the bottom, engineers, technicians, even people sweeping the floor, for all I know, are going to be paying off big time because they followed the opportunity and their desire. Now, it's not always going to lead to a lot of money, but it will lead to opportunity. I mean, one thing I point to, when I was a young engineer at Boeing, I'm thinking, okay, I want to go up in the aviation as a whole, not just Boeing as a company. And it's like, how can I have an influence over a broad range of people in the aviation community? And I thought, like, there are three different ways. A, become some large scale executive in an organization or in a government organ entity. B, be somebody who's famous for writing books about aviation or aviation safety. And C, do something, I mean, be a hero pilot or some heroic sort of entity within aviation, astronaut, pilot, etc. Never that I thought in a million years that A, something like the internet would come along, and B, suddenly everyone out there, no matter where you are in aviation, have a platform that 40 years ago only the largest organizations and sovereign governments had access to, a global communications network. Now, does it mean you're going to have a billion people and hundreds of millions coming in advertising revenue? Probably not. But now, if you're an engineer, it should be part of your toolkit that to communicate what you're doing to others, that you use the various media, social media, etc., that are out there. And if you don't, you'll be at a serious disadvantage compared to your compatriots. Same thing for AI. Whether you love it or hate it, or spend too much time doing silly things with it, it's not going away. It will be part of your toolkit. So if you're thinking about learning more about it, not with the idea of making a $1 million company, but to be better at what you're doing, do so.
I want to add just one last comment. I'm sure it's getting close to finishing time, but I just want to say that this 46 years now for me has not been pain-free. And I think that applies to everybody. So those of who have been in the business for a long time, it's fair to say we have lash marks on our scars. That's one of my favorite phrases. But the fact is, it doesn't matter. Whichever direction you go in life, whether you're going to be a cab driver or an engineer or a CEO, there's going to be pain associated with it, but just push through that. Because the rewards continue if you're on the path that you're made to be on.
I'm laughing when you said that because I went almost 10 years without ever missing a day's work because I love the job. But boy, I got scars on my butt
I
from
don't
being bit
swear.
on from, not only mistakes I made, my crew made mistakes, and I was one of those guys that said, it's my crew, I'm responsible. And I got yelled at many, many times, because we did something we shouldn't have done, or we made a mistake.
Each one is a
Mostly, it
badge
was
of
something
honor.
we shouldn't have been.
Exactly. Each
When there
one is
was
a
no
badge of honor, guys.
work, what was that saying going about mice?
When the cat's away,
Anyway, if there was no work, boy, we could get in trouble quick.
they're here.
Yeah.
Boy, they
Guys,
just
so.
flash back to the first time I got in trouble at Boeing. I was brand new, been there only a few months. And an article I wrote with my professor when I was still in graduate school before Boeing was talking about aviation safety. And somehow or another, various news organizations got a hold of that and they misinterpreted saying that, oh, certain kinds of aircraft are more likely to crash. And the president of Qantas is like calling up management way above me, talking about, what's this guy at Boeing saying? Well, first of all, I wasn't at Boeing at the time. Second of all, they got the story wrong. But still, I'm being yelled at by the president of a very large customer of Boeing, and I'm barely there a couple of months, and I'm thinking, is my career coming to a sudden stop?
It did because you joined us.
you go. Yes, we're all doomed.
I stayed at Boeing long enough to collect a pension too. So,
There we go.
not as
All
many
right,
years, so
Todd.
it's not a huge pension.
It's time for your last word, Todd.
Oh, my second to last word. Who knew we'd have so much fun talking about engineering and not talking about regulations and air, details of how things work, especially at the FAA, which we'll, get upset about. But we're talking about that part of what we do that gets us excited, that keeps us doing this decade after decade. So if some of that enthusiasm is washed off on you, we've done our job.
Yes.
Indeed.
And I,
Ditto.
you want to mass, you want to join in? You want to have a last word, Mike?
I think I basically already said, I think all three of us are where we belong right now. And we all three passionate about this. Greg as well, he left a bit early. But we are passionate about what we do, and the knowledge comes with passion, and the judgment comes with the knowledge. So it matters. That's all. Thank you.
All right, and I'll say the I'm going to change my last word today, because in looking at some accidents, preparing for future podcasts, I have noticed a number of student pilot accidents, and the issues around liability when a student pilot damages an airplane. And including what is considered an accident. I saw one on landing, an axle broke, right? So he gets the that pilot gets the credit for the accident, but was that axle fatigue cracked? There's a lot of questions in there. The NTSB did not do that detailed kind of analysis on that accident, so it's an open question, right? It's just an event as far as the NTSB is concerned. But he gets that pilot on that airplane gets dinged for having an accident, and also, depending on the insurance policy that the location that he rented that airplane, he may be liable for a lot of money. So my comment out there for all of our student pilots that are out there is an insurance policy. Our sponsor gives it. Other people have it. A renter's insurance policy. It's relatively cheap. And or inexpensive, I should say, and it covers you, and including some attorney fees. So please, if you're a student pilot, consider getting yourself covered financially with a renter's insurance policy. Todd, you have it. Greg has it. It's money well spent. So to all the students out there, please consider getting yourself some insurance to protect yourself financially. And remember, good job of pre-planning, good job of pre-flighting, and when you get in the air, put the head on a swivel. Please, please fly safely.
Let me talk to the folks who have joined the Flight Safety Detectives, our members. We thank you very much for doing so, and we're hoping that you are enjoying your membership and the benefits that come with that, including getting early access to new episodes and other goodies to be determined later. And if you're interested in becoming a member, you'll see a graphic on the screen with an arrow pointing to the join button on the YouTube channel. Join. Do what is necessary to become a member at whatever level you'd like and enjoy those benefits. And if you have questions, whether or not you're a member or not, write to us at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. And we're not leaving out sponsors. We love sponsors. We can always use more, and we hope that you can use our content to attract our audience to your product or service. Contact us at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. We'll have a conversation.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
For decades, Avemco Insurance Company has been an advocate for pilot safety by promoting and sponsoring continuous pilot training and education. One of their initiatives has been to reward pilots who actively participate in being more proficient with savings on their insurance premium through the Avemco Safety Rewards program. Pilots save by earning new ratings, getting recurrent training, participating in the Fast Team Wing program, and listening to podcasts like ours and other Avemco-related courses and training. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for an automatic 5% off.